Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon. My name is John Wilkes, welcoming you back to The Whole Shebang, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network. The program today, we're asking the ticklish question, is it the last roundup for Hawaii's free-roaming heritage sheep and goats? As the ongoing aerial eradication policy of non-native sheep and goats causes rifts across the Hawaiian Islands, I'd like to welcome a couple of guests to the show today, Tony Sylvester and hopefully Canolo Sproat. He's tied up on a line and will be with us very shortly. So what is the future for these free-ranging animals? Listen to The Whole Shebang for some answers. I want to welcome Tony. Tony Sylvester is a fourth-generation Hawaiian. He works in radio astronomy atop Mauna Kea on the Big Island. Tony is a former chair of the Hawaii County Game Management Advisory Group and current board member of the Hunting, Farming, and Fishing Association of Hawaii. Hunting, farming, and fishing play a vital role in Tony's everyday life. Game animals in Hawaiian culture serve as an important food source. With increasing awareness of the uniqueness of these wild sheep and goats, Tony, like many others, believe Hawaii's undomesticated livestock should be preserved for their genetic diversity. Tony, aloha. Welcome.
Aloha, John. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Hopefully, Canolo will be with us shortly. Canolo is the wildlife biologist for the Big Island, and he'll be with us very soon, we're hoping. Tony.
Great.
Can we just put a bit of history into this? How did this all start? Where did these animals, where did they come from, do we think?
Oh, okay. Originally, with Captain Cook and Captain Vancouver on their original stopovers to the Hawaiian Islands, they had dropped off some sheep and goats and some cattle. And what brought this to an interesting point is that they don't know, you know, the routes that these sailors and captains took and animals that they put on their ships. You know, we really don't know where they originally came from. And with the geographic isolation we have here in Hawaii, you know, these animals are dropped off in a few locations at some of the leeward side of the island where it's calm waters and the ships could anchor and they could roll to shore. So these animals were given to, you know, some of the royalty, the chiefs of that ahupua, that land strip that belonged to that particular chief. And, you know, these animals were cherished at that time because, you know, Hawaii didn't have many sources of land protein other than the pua, the wild pig. So to see these unique, rare-looking animals from an ancient Hawaiian perspective, you know, was a valuable commodity for them. So they cherished them. They put a kapu on them. Without any predators here at that time, you know, they thrived.
Right. I gather, because we're talking about 1790, around there, in that sort of ballpark.
And, yeah, you look around 1793.
Yeah. And they were protected. Mm-hmm. The capo, the royal protection, lasted for, what, about 10 years? For everything. So nothing could be taken or hunted or killed in the 10 years. And of course, these animals came to an all-day green banquet, and they did very well. I believe the cattle situation got incredibly out of hand.
Oh, yes, tremendous, where they moved up into the 9,000-foot elevations of our mountains and started completely deforesting, along with man. You know, man contributed to probably half of the deforestation here in Hawaii, and the cattle, you know, took care of the rest, so... Yeah, those two big culprits there.
They were the first sort of the first big breeds to come in and multiply. I mean, the numbers are quite staggering. I mean, there was by 1903 there was something like 100,000 wild sheep on Mauna Kea or thereabouts. And so obviously these things did quite a bit of damage historically. And could you shed some light? The reason it's become very, very kind of heated is because of the preservation of a very small bird which relies on the Mamani forest, which the sheep love to eat, the papilla bird, yeah?
Yes, that's correct. But that's just one specific area of our island, or the Mauna Kea, and it encompasses about 78,000 acres. And the Mamani forest was found much lower at the time, but it was such a good wood for burning, for heat, and for fence posts. So a lot of the early ranching cut down a lot of the Mamani trees in the lower elevation. So the only thing you have left is this band of Mamani up around 7,000 to 9,000 feet. And that's kind of the area that they're trying to protect today. That's the only place that the bird is found, you know, on this island. And the sheep love that area too, so they've been coexisting for several hundred years. And I think the problem that we're seeing today is that with the federal mandate that they have to remove all ungulates from the mountain, that the mountain has now turned into an extreme fire hazard.
Right.
And that I don't know, but back at the turn of the century, they realized they needed to cut the number of ungulates, sheep and goats down, but not get rid of all of them. And today's approach is to get rid of all of them. And I think we're starting to see the signs of that in other areas on the island that hasn't been eradicated, where we're getting large fires. And then everything suffers, yes? All wildlife, all native species, you know, when you get a burn of 1,000 acres, it's gone. It's done. It'll never regenerate again. So
right.
We have to watch what we're doing here.
So it's a federal mandate that these animals have to be removed. And I think, I gather, within the islands, it's fairly contentious because the state maybe doesn't want to do it, but they're being forced into it because these animals are endangered, these little birds are endangered, and therefore they have every kind of preservation going. And it's putting you guys, you know, because as I explained in your introduction, you're a hunter, a very keen, avid hunter, mm-hmm. of sustainable hunting. And it's a big part of your culture, hunting.
Absolutely, and it's as Native Hawaiians, it's also a process of gathering. The Native Hawaiians necessarily didn't use the word hunt; they gathered. So when they went up into the forest and the mountains, it was a part of their gathering, and it's protected under state and federal constitution that their gathering rights, their traditions, and culture should be maintained. So we're at the point, well, if you're getting rid of these animals, and even though they weren't here originally, the native people utilize them as a food resource, and we have to maintain that today because many Native Hawaiians and many other local people and people from away hunt, and most people here in Hawaii hunt. We don't hunt for sport; we hunt for food.
Yeah, I think that's a point. I was talking to Kelsey Toshima, who's the VP of the Hawaiian Sheep and Goat Association, and he was adamant that. Harvesting, if you want to put it, these free-ranging animals is an integral part for many Hawaiians in the backcountry. This is a food staple. It isn't necessarily about a hunting thing. It is about putting meat on the table.
Yes, absolutely. We're an island state, and, you know, much like Alaska, where they depend on subsistence hunting. You know, over here, it helps with our monthly bills. I mean, you know, the cost of animal protein and things like that here is very high. Dairy products is very high. So, to have our own ice box, as we call it, in our backyard, in our mountains, yeah. It's been very important. And I think close to 20% of our protein here on this island is from our wild game resources.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, that's a very notable figure. It's the, and also, I mean, this leads into larger issues around land usage on the islands and the loss of hunting rights for Native Hawaiians, which is something which I think you're involved trying to, preserve these rights.
Yes. Yeah, there's certain things. Well, one of the biggest things is that in 1978, our constitutional convention that we had there, it deleted the a section in there where our game animals were a natural resource. So up until 1978, our game animals were protected also as a natural resource. That was removed by kind of a sleight of hand. And that was part of the environmental movement at that time. It was very big in the late 1970s here.
Yeah.
And that alone has kind of crippled us because now our animals have all been deemed invasive. There's other areas that don't have Kalila Bird and, you know, different parts of the islands that have game animals.
Right.
And once you put a blanket statement of an animal being invasive, it's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Even though it's not a problem in some areas. So now you get this blanket of, oh, this animal is bad, this animal is a pest, and we need to get rid of it. Yeah, that may be true in particular areas that you're trying to preserve, but it's not across all the landscapes. And that's what we're fighting right now, that, hey, we have areas that can sustain animals, doesn't harm the native environment. Some areas are already, from fires in the past and everything, that it's not a good substrate for native species anymore. So why can't we maintain some of our game populations and our heritage animals there?
Yeah, because I think it's worth noting that it wasn't just animals, it wasn't just invasive animal species too, that the island basically has a lot of invasive plants, and that it's a catch-22 or whatever, because the animals that caused the original damage, you've got to say, are now responsible for stopping the invasive plants, which have taken the place of the native sort of flora. And so they're now needed. It's a kind of a weird situation.
It is, yes. And, you know, because, like, especially our island here, the Hawaii island itself, it's much newer. So the substrate, we have lava flows. So you have some place that's 500 years old, and you have an area that's 5,000 years old, and you have an area that's 600,000 years old. So you, amongst these different substrates, you know, the native species has evolved in different pockets and niches in itself.
Right.
But, you know, like I said, fire comes through, and then it burns. Well, the native species are very slow growing, and there's no way they can compete with alien plants and grasses and things like that. So, you know, in an instant fire, the landscape changes forever. So, you know, and what prevents more fires from happening is the ungulates.
Yeah.
They actually use cattle to prevent fire in a lot of areas.
So,
and the reason is just control the cattle.
Just to clarify, ungulate is a cloven hoofed animal. Technically, is that so? There can be a pig, a pig, a goat, a sheep, or as long as it's cloven footed. Because that's something I just wanted to clarify. The idea that the invasive plants, because I was speaking to one of the state people on Maui. And he'd intimated that there'd been a few trials done where areas had been fenced off, and such is the scale of the damage, if you like, of the goats, particularly on Maui, that what grows back, it's you just don't get a grow back of the original native flora as you'd hope. I mean, it'd be lovely if it would, but you tend to get. I mean, what sort of plants are we talking? The invasive plants are the most problematic.
Yeah, right now here on the island of Hawaii in the higher elevation is called fireweed. It's a Madagascar fireweed. And it literally spread like wildfire over the last 10 years. And that is toxic to livestock. So cattle and horses will die if they eat too much of that.
Right.
The sheep and goats have a tendency they can tolerate it. And they in some areas they actually enjoy it. So once they got rid of a lot of the sheep from Mauna Kea, it's kind of a direct correlation that after the sheep has been cut down from about 2,000 to about 50, that the fireweed has exploded on the mountain. And then a little bit lower elevations is fountain grass, and that's another. It grows 5 to 6 feet high, and it usually once a fire burns through, that fountain grass just comes right back. That's part of its life cycle.
Right.
Feeds it, you know. The fire feeds it. It fertilizes the seeds, and the whole landscape gets altered. And it grows so thick, nothing else can take foot.
I see. At the exclusion of all other sort of plants. And I mean, I gather there are issues around on some of the islands. There is issues around erosion taking place because of the nature of the extreme grazing that's gone on.
Yeah, the Kauai and Molokai especially, because they have cliffs right to the ocean, and then, you know, they have the reefs below, and the hunters can't really get in some of those areas. So, yeah, there's potential problems there. For Hawaii Island here, we don't have that type of island. Our island's much newer, so we don't have cliffs right at the ocean. in that sense, that way, yeah. So our game animals are further inland, 12 to 20 miles inland from the coast.
I see.
And they're more drier sides of the island. You know, they just prefer the drier areas except for the pig.
And so if we can get down to the nitty-gritty on the numbers, I mean, I looked some numbers up. I mean, the aerial culling takes place of the sheep, particularly on Mauna Kea. And over the last 3 years, the numbers, I think, about nearly 3,000 have been taken out, just 28 goats. So it's mostly 3,000 of the wild sheep. 2013, there was 2,000 taken out. 2014, 700. And 2015, 226. So it's obviously working that they're reducing the number substantially. Is there the meat? The meat that comes from these animals, is it all able to be consumed by the native Hawaiians, or does it have to be left where it's shot in some cases?
The hunters pushed years ago, back in the 1990s, that said, "Hey, this is not pono. Pono means, you know, doing something that's right." And it wasn't pono at that time that they're shooting large amounts of animals and leading them to rot. So by the pressure from the hunting community, they started kind of a recovery program for some of the animals. And you'd have to get a permit, and you meet at a particular location, and they would shoot some of the animals and put it in a net, and they would drop it off at these particular locations.
Right.
The thing is, it was very restrictive, limited to like 10 permits, so only 10 vehicles could go, and so forth. And it the state wants to do it, but the feds don't, because every minute that they're wasting recovering an animal, they could be shooting more animals.
Right.
So the Fed here is our problem, overreaching, and I think we've seen that in a number of cases these days, but particularly here in Hawaii, where it's extreme, you know, measures, and they're not listening to the people and what the people want. We understand we need to protect our native environments, but, you know, there's a pono, proper ways to do things, and just shooting them and leaving them to rot. We can understand if it's on a steep cliff, but back to Mauna Kea, we don't have that here. We can traverse the mountain relatively easy. There's access almost everywhere. So there's no excuse to be shooting and leaving animals up there to rot. Some cannot help it, you know, depending on poor place shots and things like that, and we understand. But the consensus is that you have to try to recover as much meat as possible.
Right. And the Department of Land and Natural Resources, I mean, one of their kind of things they throw up is that basically that the native Hawaiian hunting people won't be able to be as efficient on the ground as they are in a chopper taking these animals out to be able to achieve the culling levels they need. You know, there's figures, I think somebody's quoted as saying there were 747 trips and just 48 sheep harvested. But is that the case, or is there more to it than that?
Well, now it is, because there's so few animals, and the only real way they can target the remaining is through Judas animals, where they radio collar animals and release them, and then they go back and find others, and then they're able to zero in with the tracking collars.
Right.
To shoot them out. The ironic part of all this is that they're complaining about the Mamani forest being eaten by the sheep, but the forest is so thick that they can't shoot the animal. That's the problem.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're actually up in there and you tell yourself there's 1.5 million Mamani trees, of that 900,000 is seeding, and that's what the bird requires.
I see.
So you have 900,000 trees that are producing food for a bird that's going extinct. And there's many other factors. There's wild feral cats. And they decimate the native bird populations there, and there's rats. And, of course, you have native hawks and owls and stuff like that. So there's a lot of predation on the palila bird also, and they haven't really gotten that fully under control. And also the palila bird is a male-biased population, so two-thirds or more of the birds are males. So you don't have enough females, and they're yearling success. In other words, the ones that make it to one-year-old is only like 2.6%.
Wow.
So, it's more than just the sheep thing. I mean, we can see in another 100 years, because there's no new regeneration of new trees, that you could reach a critical point. But right now, as it stands, there's so much other factors that's suppressing the species, the palila bird, and they're only focusing on the sheep. And
right.
We think that that's also wrong too. Yeah.
The sheep are very much in the frame for all that. It's a very, very it's a difficult situation for everybody involved. Obviously, you've got big, shall we say, environmental bodies involved on the islands, the Sierra Clubs,
yeah,
and the Nature Conservancies and the Urban Societies, who are, you know, obviously, yeah, passionate about preserving these the bird as it's, and seeing that the legislation's in place and it's carried out, that the sheep and goats are taken out. What's the feeling on the island towards these organizations, between the hunting groups? Is there sort of like an impasse, or how does it work?
I think, you know, they do some good work, and as hunters, we are conservationists. In fact, we were the first conservationists, you know. We realized back in the U.S. mainland at the turn of the century that people were hunting out all, coming down from the cities, crossing state lines, and they were killing all the native wildlife there, elk and deer, and the hunters had to step in and say, hey, we're not going to have anything left. So they were the first conservationists. So we are here in Hawaii, even though our animals are introduced, same thing, you know, we have to protect our native flora and fauna, and we understand conservation, and there are areas that should be 100% preserved. But that's one of our biggest targets, is that there's a big difference between conservation and preservation. You know, conservation is wise use of all our resources, and it provides access, whereas preservation is no use, no touch. And that's where we're running into problems here, that they're trying to change all of Hawaii into preservation.
Right.
So then we have no, it's exclusive. And then it becomes exclusive to only these NGOs, these non-governmental agencies, like the Nature Conservancy and so forth, where they have the access to all these areas. They have the playground. They get to build their cabins in there to do their research and studies, and they work with other groups and partnerships, and it becomes exclusive. And then the local people and the local population here, we have no access there. We have to pay to go to some of these areas. And it's, whoa, this is native lands, this is our lands, and yet now we have to pay to, if we want to go, or we don't have access to go at all. So,
right.
Yeah, the NGOs and these nonprofit environmental groups, you know, they do some good work, but they're also becoming very exclusive here.
Uh-huh. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when you come back, I'd like to talk about the heritage nature of these sheep. There's exciting stuff going on, and I'd like to talk about that in a little bit more detail. We're going to cut away to a break now. Tony, thank you, and we'll be back very shortly to continue the conversation. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Dues Paid by RecTech.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins, I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to the second half of the show. And we're very pleased to welcome to the show Kanalo Sproat. Kanalo's joining us from the Big Island, Hawaii. Kanalo is the wildlife biologist for the State of Hawaii Division of Forestry and Wildlife. He is a native Hawaiian with both a BS and MS in Wildlife and Wildlands Conservation from Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Here, he studied the Rocky Mountain and Desert Bighorn at both undergraduate and graduate level. Before assuming his current role, Kanalo worked as a field technician and then as Maui Axis Deer Program Coordinator. He's soon to be coordinating work to fit 40 of these rarer breeds of sheep with collars, with satellite collars, and they're going to be tracked at the same time. DNA sampling will be taken to see if we can hopefully find some origins, define the origins of these breeds. Aloha, Kanalo, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Aloha, John. Thanks for having me on. I should say real quick, and it's my fault I wrote it to you, I'm not necessarily the wildlife biologist. I'm an a wildlife biologist for the state.
Okay, right. You're one of several. Okay.
No, well, you didn't. I wrote that to you, so.
Okay. Well,
my bad.
Well, it makes you sound very impressive. We like that.
Yeah, I know.
But thank you. Obviously, you and Tony know each other, so I don't need to make any introductions there. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to any of the show, but we've been talking about the sort of the bigger picture of the damage and how it's managed and the aerial culling. And I mean, you guys are the guys that are involved with this aerial eradication, yeah?
Yes, sir.
And you carry, and it's carried out at the moment, it's carried out on Mauna Kea.
Yes.
And the so I gather though that you are going to be doing some really interesting work, and Tony and I were going to come on to this in relation to the heritage nature of these sheep, fitting them with collars, some rams and ewes of these remaining few heritage sheep, so you can track them to see what's going on.
Yes, sir.
That's,
you want some details?
I'd love some details, yes. No, because I think it's utterly fascinating.
Yeah, just a little background. As I'm sure you guys already spoke about, all of the ungulates that we have here for hunting purposes or whatever it is are not native. And so we have federal laws, especially with the Endangered Species Act, that regulate what we can and cannot do to enhance or to improve ungulate populations, which really... the laws pretty much limit, bind our hands. There's not much we can do. One of the things that's happening at Pu'uva'ava and Pu'uanahulu, where these heritage sheep are, and we're not doing eradications, is we have a habitat conservation plan. Essentially, what this plan does is gives us an incidental take permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which allows us to improve and to enhance these, you know, sheep populations and goat populations, with the understanding that they are going to damage some of our native plants, especially the rare and endangered ones. And so we're going to protect the areas where those plants are in the highest abundance, try to get rid of the animals from those areas,
right,
and outside those fences manage for, you know, to improve these populations for hunting purposes. So this HCP is in public review right now. It should be finished the end of this month. And then however long it takes for us to eventually get it in, implemented, should be hopefully, you know, by the end of the year. So part of that enhancing the population is I wanted to just get basic population parameters, understand movements, understand survival. We are, because we're going to be handling so many animals, I am going to take blood. I'm still trying to figure out what kind of DNA test to do on them. But we would like to find out what, you know, what their history is, their DNA history. So it's just a little bit, yeah. So I don't know if you have more questions or like me to elaborate on anything. Just let me know.
Well, no, I mean it's very exciting. I think Tony, if I could bring you in here, is because yeah. I think we need to make it clear that there's almost two breeds of sheep. of wild sheep. There's the mouflon, there is the mouflon, which is now the sort of the predominant introduced species, which has only been on the island a relatively short 30 years. But then there are these older sheep which have crossed with the mouflon, and the populations have expanded of those sheep. But there are a few pockets of these original sheep left, and I think that's what the focus is for you, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes, and that's why we have several things going on right now to help with this. And one is a resolution in this year's state legislature that looks back into putting some of our game animals back as a national resource. It's just bringing awareness that some of these animals have value, and that's going to be part of what we're doing. The value to our game and heritage keep is most important. If we can reassign value back to these animals, then I can start kind of changing the narrative that we need to protect some of the traditional heritage animals that arrived here years ago. The problem is the mouflon sheep came in the 60s, and they're a much better, more desirable game animal for hunting. So the hunting community prefers those. So our heritage animals are kind of suffering because of that. And as a hunter, I enjoy the mouflon cross, but you know, as an animal lover, I look at these heritage animals, our original sheep here, and have to try to find a way to preserve some in their state in some of these geographically isolated areas.
I mean, they're fascinating looking. They're wonderful looking sheep, and I mean these animals could trace their origins back to Vancouver and Cook.
Absolutely, yes. And they also taste really good too, John.
That's the main thing. And I mean, Canalo, coming back to you, I mean, it's quite an exciting prospect, really, trying to work out, you know, where these animals came from.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of books out there that state that we have Rambouillet and Merino kind of mixed out there, but really there's nothing documented more than that.
So what the work you're doing is pretty well going to be groundbreaking and help define these animals. I mean, they're an important resource. I mean, in the sense of the sort of the biodiversity they offer. I'd like to quote Dr. Alison Martin, who's the executive director of the Livestock Conservancy, and she says that the native sheep and goats of Hawaii represent genetics found nowhere else in the world, and many of their ancestral breeds have disappeared. They've evolved and adapted over an extremely long period to self-sufficient life in the islands. So, you know, as I say, the Livestock Conservancy are very interested in the work you're going to do. So these populations, is there a possibility that they could be, because at the moment they can go anywhere, I mean, they're free-ranging, as the name sounds. Would there be the possibility some of these animals could actually be, when I say farmed, or put into areas where they are contained so that they can escape the mouflon influence?
There's a potential for that, and definitely if we, you know, if the results of any testing showed that they were unique and worth that, we would definitely look into that for sure.
And I gather it's really interesting. There'll be, what, collared, and if you could tell us a bit about the process as to what will happen on a daily basis.
Well, the GPS collars will send out two fixes a day, so we'll get two coordinates of where the animals are every day. We're going to try to visually locate every collared individual at least every other week, about twice a month. That way we can get the demographics of all the other animals that are with them. We can find out things like ram to ewe ratio, lamb to ewe ratio, see if we can get some fecundity information, some reproductive information. But those fixes are uploaded to a satellite and posted on a website that we have access to, so once a day. So pretty much we can come into work in the morning and find out where all those sheep are and try to go find them and try to find out who's with them and get their movements and get, you know, all the demographics and all that kind of information that can be useful for us as we model the population, as we try to improve the herd.
Yeah, to basically try and keep it pure in a way. That's the thing. And I would imagine that makes you very happy, Tony.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, it's these animals are found across fences. So Kamehameha School, which is Bishop Estates, they have a lot on their property, too. So but a lot of guys are now leasing land from them and bringing in mouflon. So yes, it's going to be a critical moment where, you know, the influence of mouflon is going to take over all these areas. It's just that the mouflon are normally found higher up, and now they've worked their way down because of the I think the eradications and the fencing higher up. So yeah, I'd like to see some of them get protected.
Because Canella, we had a conversation a while back, and you intimated that some of the idea of introducing the mouflon, which is a wild breed of sheep from Europe, I think, originally, the idea that these sheep would kind of negate the flocking instinct of these hereditary Hawaiian sheep to kind of disperse them a bit, but that perhaps didn't work. I don't know.
From conversations with people, I think it worked a little bit, but there were so many sheep on the mountain, it kind of, I don't know if it really mattered after a while, the way that they managed it to the levels they managed it to, I'm not sure. Yeah, it mattered in the end.
And on, just to be clear, on Mauna Kea, because of the sort of the listing on the endangered species list of the papilla bird, the idea is that Mauna Kea will be cleared of all ungulates. That sort of has to happen because it's federal law. Is that the case?
Yes, sir. I mean, not necessarily federal law, but we were mandated in the courts. We lost the court battle pretty badly. And so there's a fence being built around the mountain. It's not complete, but it should be complete soon.
Right.
They've been doing aerial eradications, and they've been pretty successful at that. So the numbers of sheep on Mauna Kea are extremely low.
Yeah, I quoted the figures when we were talking with Tony. Down, I think, in the last six operations in 2015, I think there was about 225 sheep, and 3 years before it was nearly, it was like 2,000. So I mean, they're getting less. But the hope is that, okay, if Mauna Kea is cleared, that there will be room for these animals elsewhere.
That's the hard part. PCA, the military area there, they're going to be basically eradicating most of their land, their lease land there also. So we're running out of habitat. Other than private land, yeah, as far as public hunting, yeah, it's shrinking drastically here.
Right. So the area that is suitable for these animals is declining. And I know, I think I was looking at something the other day that at the end of January, there's a quite an important sort of political situation going on with the for the DLNR being able to do aerial culling on state lands. Is that the case, Tony? Is that something that's going?
Well, there's kind of an ongoing battle between some of us within the hunting community and that there was a state law that made aerial shooting illegal throughout the state from back in the 1930s already.
Right.
So we kind of challenged it. What happened was we understood Mauna Kea as a federal mandate and protect threatened endangered species there, but that eradication effort from helicopters started spreading throughout the entire island, Manuka, Waihai, and it eventually ended up by Hualalai, where they're shooting cattle and there's a lot of people that live in that area now. People are freaking out. There's all this rapid gunfire from helicopters.
Right, okay.
So the community started complaining, and we started looking into it, and we found out that there was a state law that you couldn't shoot from a helicopter. So we challenged that and said, hey, you know, we understand if it's steep cliffs or if the federal mandates, but the agencies or departments were starting to fly and shoot animals everywhere. Then you started getting Kamehameha schools and Parker Ranch and all these other places. Everybody's just jumping in helicopters and eradicating animals.
Right.
So we have to put a stop to that, and we did a county ordinance to ban area eradication on this island. And that still holds, but there's a state bill that they're putting forth this year to grant them permission to start flying again.
Right. Canella, in your, I mean, obviously your work, it's more than just sheep and goats, because on the islands there are several introduced species which I presume originally were introduced with sort of hunting in mind. So it there is other stuff which can cause problems. Is that the case? Other animals, deer and axis deer and things like that?
Yeah. The question of if there's axis deer in this island is not really answered yet. It's questionable. But definitely there's other things. And, you know, I also deal with native wildlife species, right? So we do things with nanny goose and with other birds and stuff. But as far as hunting and managing other species, for sure, you know, there's cattle and goat and pigs. None of it's native. They all do damage to some degree.
Right.
So we're trying to find the balance between providing them as a resource, which is a state law. It is in our laws to provide hunting as a resource for our public, but at the same time protecting the endangered plants and animals and all that from any harm or damage that the introduced species can cause is a fun job.
Right. Yeah, no, I can see you walk up. It's a difficult job you have to do, and I'm fully appreciative of that. And, I mean, what would be, I mean, it sounds a very ridiculous question probably, but what would be the perfect solution to all this? If I could go to, say, Canala, what would be the sort of the best solution for all this? In the sense of, you know, numbers to a level that can be controlled sustainably. Would that be something which would be a runner?
I guess, you know, in a perfect world, we would find out what kind of damage is acceptable.
Right.
And what levels of, like you're saying, what numbers of animals would be needed to, you know, to stay under that threshold. And then manage them and keep them at those levels, I guess.
And would that be would that be achievable? Do you think is it something that could be achieved?
Can it be? I mean, can it be? Sure, but our political atmosphere here is it makes that real difficult.
Right.
So there's a lot of changes there that need to happen first.
I see. I hear what you're saying. And if I put that to you, Tony, what would you say on that one?
Well, I have one thing I'd like to quote, first of all, and it's called a human resource, and it's called sustainable land management, and this is something that the UN summit has looked at, because it's a global thing in other areas, especially third world countries in Africa and all that, where there's conflict between resources and humans. But this sustainable land management, I think that's a good practice for some place like here, and it basically recognizes that people, the human resources, and the natural resources on which they depend directly or indirectly are inextricably linked. Rather than treating each in isolation, all ecosystem elements are considered together in order to obtain multiple ecological and social economic benefits. And I think if we start looking into approaches like that, that they will help, because people like Kanalu guys on the ground, you know, their hands are really tied, and we understand that. And they got to take a lot of the flack from the public, because those are the people you see.
Right.
But it's the administration, it's the higher up, the mandates that they have to follow, and then the influences politically and so forth. And that's where we come in, and we're trying to work and help to loosen these guys up, try to get them some more money, get them more resources so they can do these things, try to change some of the laws to allow the guys on the ground for DLNR to be able to actually go in there and do stuff. Because we know it's hard. It's got to be a tough job to constantly get complaints from hunters and then from the environmentalists. And so I give them credit, and I appreciate their effort. And hang in there with us. You know, it's a tough crowd.
Well, it seems like that there's a spirit of goodwill breaking out all of a sudden as we draw to the end of the show. But It's been a fascinating look at what is an incredibly complicated issue. I understand that, and I really do appreciate you being able to come on, Canalo. Really, thank you for that. It's made a
thanks. Sorry for the miscommunication earlier.
No, don't worry. We're fine. It was a privilege to have you come on towards the end. And Tony, thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate it. And look forward to catching up with you again sometime. And
great.
So to everybody, I hope this has shed some light on to the free-roaming sheep and goats on the islands of Hawaii. And hopefully there is possibly a future for these few heritage animals that are left. So without further ado, I'd like to say thank you very much to all my guests. Mahalo to you guys, and look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.